Welcome to episode 175 of The Numbers Game. It's Marty here. You'd be hoping for Jason Robinson at this stage, but that young fella is overseas in Europe running the London Marathon, and I've heard he's done well. He's done well, and I'm sure we'll hear about it in the next episode. But feeling good. Nick, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Marty. Thanks. I'm looking forward to you driving this episode. I don't know, is Jason's position in trouble or...?
Well... I don't think so.
No,
we have got a very good replacement though. And when I say very good, I say that selfishly because, as you know, Nick, I'm turning 52, and retirement is just around the corner, only another 15 years away, and I have to start, you know, learning a little bit about what that looks like. And we have a very special guest today. Now, Nick, you know this person even longer than I do. So do you want to maybe give a little bit of background on Luke Mace?
Sure can. So Luke's one of our senior financial planners at Innovate, and definitely one of our top performers for a number of reasons. Work ethic being one, and the other being he's actually really good at his job. So we talk financial planning a lot on this podcast, high level. So I thought, what better opportunity to get someone who's on the ground every day talking to people and can hopefully, you know, decipher what a financial plan out does for us. And I know, Marty, you've got some selfish technical questions you wanted to throw at Luke, you know, around, you know, how do you make millions disappear from the ATO and all those kinds of things. So we thought we'd get Luke in to have a good chat about financial planning and hopefully give our listeners some absolute gold. So Luke, welcome, and how are you, mate?
Yeah, good. Thanks for having me on. Been listening since episode one, so a bit of a thrill. Episode 175, where you're getting close to the 200, so a bit of an honour to be asked on at this point. But yeah, going well.
I actually should have mentioned that. You are definitely one of our most consistent listeners. You tell me about the episodes before they've even come out almost, I feel. So
it's part of the Monday morning routine and the Thursday morning routine, walk the dog and listen to the Numbers Game. So it's
good.
Yeah,
that's
big
good.
Big fan.
Well, I'm just thinking, you know, have we prepped Luke enough? Because, you know, him being on the podcast, this is not a performance review, Luke. Your job's not on the line. You are a top performer. So I just want you to, you know, relax and know everything's okay. When Nick and I come at you and say we want to have a meeting, it's, you know, it's quite unusual.
Alarm bells go off, yeah.
Red flags are up. So it's going to be very, very valuable. You know, how do you protect yourself against debt? How do you build your, you know, financial future? Financial literacy is probably the most, you know, important thing people need to know about apart from their health in getting by in life. And so often it becomes an afterthought. And I'm hoping what's going to happen today, and I'm sure it will, is that our listeners will really get a good indication of why they need financial guidance and having good people like yourself on the show. So welcome. But maybe give a little bit of background on yourself, Luke, to start with, and what a typical client looks like for you in your everyday workings.
Yeah, sure. So a bit about me. I've been with Innovate. It's just a bit over 4.5 years. So, you know, they say time flies when you're having fun. Started just before the all the COVID stuff kicked in. So it's, 4.5 years and been in the industry for nearly 11. So actually thinking about this the other day, it makes me feel a little bit old. I've been in an industry for that long. But in terms of what a typical client looks like, it's pretty broad. I would say there's no such thing as a typical client. I'd say pretty much anyone that is looking for guidance when it comes to their financial needs is a typical client. You know, if I look at my client base as an example, my youngest client's 20, my oldest client is 87. And then there's everybody in between. So I think one of the biggest, I guess, misconceptions that people have when they're thinking about financial planning is that you need to be rich, you need to have a lot of money. You know, don't get me wrong, there are some planners out there that specialize in those areas, but I'd say the bulk of our clients are, you know, the mums and dads, just ordinary people looking to get ahead, looking to get a handle on their money. And you know, there's often a goal or a big objective that they're looking to achieve, whether that be retirement, you know, setting their kids up, putting their kids through school, getting into a first home, varies a lot, and it comes down to the individual's needs at the end of the day. So yeah, it's quite a broad cross section of people that we deal with, you know, from young accumulators through the retirees. So it's, yeah, very broad.
Yeah, it's definitely a misconception, isn't it? And I think people, I actually feel like this is changing, because it's not just us that are promoting it. I feel a lot of people are promoting the fact that you don't need to be wealthy to have a financial planner. Financial planning is not about investing money. It's not about getting people returns or inheritance or anything like that. It's about goals and how do we get there, and I guess the planner giving you guidance. So, you know, how would you define your role as a planner in that case? As you know, what yeah. do you actually do?
Yeah, I think you've pretty much just hit the nail on the head there. Like, if I was to sum it up in a really simplistic manner, it's about understanding where somebody is at a point in time, understanding where they're trying to get to, I guess, understanding the trajectory that they're on, and then implementing a plan to get them or improve their chances of getting from point A to point B. And then, you know, from an ongoing standpoint, it's, you know, how do we adjust based on changes in their lives? You know, you can set up a plan at a point in time, but people's lives change. So I guess keeping them on track or pivoting based on what change there is in the objectives that they're trying to achieve. And, you know, the strategies that underpin what we do, it's, you know, like you said, it's super investment, cash flow, budgeting, tax, insurance, that's sort of the nuts and bolts behind it. But it really is helping people achieve whatever their stated objective is. Obviously, there's quite a bit of overlap and, you know, common objectives around retirement and, you know, whether it be a passive income target or, like I said before, wanting to help their kids go to a certain school or set them up for the future. Like, they're the common objectives that pop up. But yeah, it is just about getting people on the right track and keeping them there from an ongoing standpoint.
Yeah, Luke, with obviously people of my age are sort of coming up to retirement planning, and life just gets busy, right? Through your 20s, 30s, there's all sorts of personal goals that people are looking at, and they don't take a look at the wider picture. But I think I always, you know, my favourite line is compound interest is the eighth wonder of the world. And people don't even look at their superannuation as something that they give enough attention to. Are you seeing a trend of younger people become more interested in their overall future from what you're seeing compared to, I know in the 90s and stuff, it just wasn't happening in my age group at that time. But what's the trends you're seeing in the market at the moment, and has it shifted?
Yeah, I think particularly with, I guess, the younger demographic, you know, everyone knows Scott Pape and the Barefoot Investor. So I think as a starting point, that shed a lot more light and got people more interested in it. Obviously with, you know, social media, I know, Marty, you've talked a lot about TikTok and that sort of thing in the past, but there's so many people that are putting content out there. So there's a lot more information that's out there. And often, you know, I think if I meet with an individual or a couple or whatever it is, and they're under the age of, say, 35, I'd say more often than not, they've got a bit of a grasp on how it works, you know, basic stuff, you know, being in the right risk profile, understanding the fees that they're paying in the fund, understanding the benefits of doing things like salary sacrifice and how that can contribute to, you know, their retirement pool at the end of the day. So, yeah, I definitely think that for the younger generation, you know, information's power, as they say, and, you know, their grasp of the basic concept is definitely stronger than even 10 years ago. Like when I was starting out, I think people are becoming a lot more aware. You know, obviously there's still gaps and there's things that they don't know. They're not necessarily experts in the field, but they've got a firmer grasp by and large. Yeah.
So give me an example of being in the wrong risk profile and being on the wrong fee structure. Give me an example of what you're finding that people might not know out there.
Yeah, I'll give you a real life example of a he's about to become a client, a guy I spoke to a few weeks ago, mid-30s, you know, decent amount of super for his age. He came to us and he said, I'm concerned that my fund isn't performing as it should be. A lot of the time people come to us and say that, and it's in a market dip, you know, when everything is sort of underperforming and it's just part and parcel of investing. Now, for anyone that follows the market, you would know that the last 12 to 18 months have been pretty good. So it was a little bit odd that he'd underperformed. had a look at his portfolio. He had 55% of his funds in cash in his super fund, so earning, you know, 2-3% in that fund. So over half his money in cash. He had very little in the way of equities and shares and that sort of thing. So he was underexposed to growth-based assets. And yeah, if you look at any long-term graph from an investment return point of view, growth-based assets like shares and property, infrastructure, all that sort of stuff, they will typically outperform cash, bonds, you know, term deposits, safer type investments. So he was underexposed for his age profile. Now, if he was 65 and not 35, that might have made a bit more sense. But he was literally leaving, you know, we did a bit of a comparison, just comparing it to a standard high growth fund. And he was about 4% per annum off over the last 7 years from a compounding point of view. So if he's got 100 grand over the last 7 years, even using simple numbers, he's down around 30 grand. You compound that over a 20 to 30 year period if he takes no action. I didn't run the numbers, but there'd be a massive difference in terms of what he ends up with, you know, when he's 60, 65 and looking to retire. So getting it wrong from an asset allocation point of view can make massive differences over the long term. And it can be the same the opposite way. You know, if someone comes in and they're 65 and they've just pulled the pin and retired and they're completely exposed to equity markets and they don't have a high risk tolerance or they can't afford to have a high risk tolerance, you know, it can have dire consequences as well. So, you know, it's just about understanding where someone's at and what the appropriate risk profile needs to be.
Getting the balance right, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And often it's about time. It's a time thing. You know, the longer time you have. So super's an easy one. If someone's 30, you know, you can't get your super out typically until you're 60 at this point. So we're talking 30 years. So if you see volatility and dips in the market, you're not going to need to sell it down. So you can afford to be a bit more aggressive. You said that compounding is the eighth wonder of the world. So
I read this on the weekend and it was like, if you're 18 years of age and you put $10,000 into super compounding at 8%, you know, by the time you retire, it'll be worth $434,000. And that's not too far away from what the average super is in this day and age. Like, that's $10,000 without any extra, you know, putting anything extra in. Now, obviously, that 434 is not going to be of the same value in 50 years' time as it is now, but it just goes to show you that impact, and the earlier you can get into it, the better. You know, it's so yeah. powerful to have the advice.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, super in particular, it's a, I wouldn't say it's an easy one, but it's an easy win for a planner to demonstrate value. But like you said, even with no contributions, you can see what the power of compounding does. You factor in contributions. You know, most people are going to be working a job. You know, an employer is going to be putting in, you know, it's 11% as a minimum contribution, you know, going to 11.5% next financial year. You factor that into it and it's quite incredible what the numbers do over the journey. And obviously the longer you've got to allow that investment to compound, the better off you'll be, you know, down the track when you want to realize that investment. So, yeah, it's pivotal to pay attention to what is happening. Yeah, and I think, again, younger, and I'm 32, so I'm in this bracket. I don't really see super as, it's a long way away until I'm going to get it, but at the end of the day, it's my money, and it's going to contribute heavily in terms of what my standard of living is going to be when I retire one day. So it doesn't take a lot to get it right. So, yeah, it's a very important one.
Yeah, I like what you said there around knowledge is power. And I think for a lot of young people, it is purely knowledge because there's, you know, there's just a, I don't know, maybe I could be just picking numbers here, but there might be three boxes that are really important that young people have to tick. And they've just got to make sure they're doing the right thing with their money when it comes in and when it is spare, I guess. That's really simplifying it. But if I look at our business and where you add ultimate value, it's to those people thinking about retirement. And I think because it's such an unknown, you talk, again, knowledge is power. There is no knowledge about retirement and what that looks like for people. They've been working their whole lives. They've tried to do the right thing, putting money aside in, you know, assets or savings or paying down houses, whatever that might be. So, you know, if you could just unpack, you know, the typical person that comes to you and is looking for help because they're close to retirement. You know, Marty mentioned 15 years, but you know, someone that's 5 years away, like, what are those conversations like? Because people must be worried. And I think about that because I think, geez, imagine having being retired, you've got a certain amount of money and you're not adding to that pot anymore. You haven't got the safety net of, I'll just work longer, or I'll just curb my living expenses. You just can't do that. This is the nest egg and it's got to last me now for the next 20 years. How do you go dealing with people like that? It must be challenging, I would have thought.
I'd say in terms of the situations that we see, this is the most stressful area because, like you said, you know, there's a finite amount of time, there's a finite amount of money that they're going to have when that retirement age comes. And if they do get it wrong, they're either going to be compromising on what that retirement looks like. Some people might have to go back to work. They might need to sell and move somewhere they don't want to live. It might mean that they can't help out their kids as much. So it's something that people are extremely worried about, and they want to make sure that they're, I guess, giving themselves the best chance of getting it right. Like, the conversation's typically around, you know, like you said, time frame is one. So if someone is, I don't know, 60 and they want to retire at 65, it's about understanding where they're at. Again, kind of like what I said before, what trajectory are they on? What sort of standard of living do they want in retirement? And what I mean by that is trying to quantify, I guess, what sort of income they need coming in retirement to be comfortable. So, you know, what are their objectives? Do they want to be doing international trips every year? You know, are they more interested in domestic travel? You know, what's the travel budget? What are they spending at the moment on general living costs? You know, to give context, the recent stats say that 70 grand a year is the average for a comfortable retirement for a retired couple these days. You know, you factor some travel and stuff like that on top, you know, a bigger international trip once every year or two, and that pushes up. And once you understand all those parts of the equation, you can understand, well, this is where you need to be. You need to have, you know, X amount of money saved up, whether it's super, whether it's property, combination of both mixed in with other investments, to generate a passive income based on, you know, a relatively conservative investment estimate. And we've got modeling software where we can do projections and understand, well, if you just keep going the way you're going, this is where you're going to end up. We estimate this is how long your money's going to last based on the trajectory that you're on. And I'd say it's also about helping people understand what their options are. You know, it's very common where you'll have a mum and dad, you know, they've lived in the same house for 30 years. And I'm talking more probably, you know, obviously most of our clients are based in Melbourne, but this goes to anyone. You know, you might say, well, if you stay where you are longer term, we anticipate that this is how long your money's going to last for if you spend, say, 80 grand a year. If you are thinking about or prepared to do a downsize and free up a bit of money by moving to, say, a smaller property or moving a little bit further out, this is what it looks like. And again, for me, it's about arming them with that information, giving them the confidence to make these decisions and understanding, well, if we pull the pin here, we know we've got at least 10 years before we need to make a decision on the big family home. We know we've got time up our sleeve. Some people want to understand what it looks like if they go real hard early in retirement. Like, I did a projection for a couple, it was last week, and they said, well, if we spend 30 grand a year for the first 10 years, do a big international trip each year, that'll see us through for travel. So if we do that and then drop the travel budget to, say, 10 grand afterwards, what does that look like? And you're just empowering them to make those decisions. You're showing them what it looks like based on data. Like, that's the biggest thing. They don't know, based on what they have, how far it's going to get them. They've got no idea how to quantify it and how to work it out. So I think showing them projections and giving them understandings of what different variables, how different variables will impact them longer term, is extremely, it's powerful in terms of helping them make decisions. And the only other thing I'd add, it can go the other way, as in I see a lot of people that are stressed that they don't have enough and they've got more than enough, but they don't know that they've got more than enough and they're working in a job they don't like, or they're working full-time when they want to be part-time because they think they have to. Like, ultimately, I think the most rewarding part's getting someone to the point where they're choosing to work rather than being forced to work.
Great point there, Luke. Because clients I've sent to you, there's two feelings they come out. Like, they know what the advice is fantastic, but there's either like this sense of relief knowing we're okay in what we want to do in the future, or a call to action where they know where to step up. But until they get that blueprint forward, they just don't know, and that uncertainty creates stress. So that's how my clients have felt after going to you and just getting that surety of the way forward. You can't really put a price on that, and even that price is not that expensive compared to that. So at all.
Yeah. And I was going to say, like, you know, I often say this, not tongue in cheek, but it's a little bit cheeky, but, you know, what's a year of your life worth? Like, if you can show someone that they can afford to retire a year early just by virtue of what they've already accumulated, like not even us doing anything fancy, that's a pretty valuable conversation and a valuable outcome for that person.
What about in regards to, like, we obviously, being a finance company as well, write a lot of mortgages for young families coming through and, you know, securing debt. What about protecting people around their debt when they take it out? What are important aspects around that we really need to consider that a lot of people don't, in order protecting families as well, Luke?
Yeah, so I think it's generally twofold. Number one is making sure that, and ideally people are doing this prior to going into, say, buying a house or buying an investment property, but understanding what, you know, what the budget looks like. So based on the current budget, how is that going to be impacted if they buy something? So making sure people are on top of their budget as much as they can be. Ideally having a buffer set up, so if something goes amiss, they've got something to fall back on. So that's the first point, just making sure that the house of cards doesn't topple over straight away if something happens. And then I guess contingency planning, like, you know, I often say our job, it's about creating a plan and then implementing a plan B, which everyone's favorite topic in this industry is life insurance. It's the least exciting thing to talk about, but it's vitally important. So, you know, you get a young couple with two young kids and a mortgage. I often ask them, if something happens and one of you can't work, you know, or the worst, you know, it's morbid, this stuff, but if the worst case happens, there's an unexpected death or something like that, what are you going to do? How are you going to keep that wheel turning from a financial standpoint? How do the mortgage payments keep getting made? How do the kids keep getting sent to school? That's where things like life insurance, income protection, disability insurance, trauma insurance, they all come in. Again, it's there to mitigate a risk. Some people say, you know, well, that stuff's not going to happen to me. And I would say it's unlikely you're going to claim on this stuff, particularly when you're younger. But I've seen, you know, as I said, 11 years in the industry, I've seen a few claims. I did a claim last year, young guy, 35 or 36. We did his app 2 years prior. He was in perfect health. He was what we call a clean skin application. So when you go for these insurances, you have to answer a heap of health questions. He had nothing wrong with him at all. He ended up in the ICU for 5 weeks, paralyzed. This rare autoimmune condition hit him out of the blue. He got a trauma payout within, I think it was 7 business days. It was about 180 grand he got paid out. And he had income protection covering him basically as soon as he was off work in this case. Now his situation, he had 2 kids under 5. His wife was on mat leave. He was self-employed, so he had no leave or anything. If he didn't have that cover, either you rely on family help or he'd be forced to sell the home, basically, or, I don't know, try and borrow against the home if he can and take out more debt just to survive. Now, fortunately, he's just gone back to 1 day a week, so he's slowly gotten back into it. But, you know, he would have been stuffed, basically, if he didn't have that cover in place. So, you know, it's protecting against the unknown by insuring yourself.
Well, it's part of the plan, right? And yeah, it's the thing that I used to say is, what takes you 10 years to build, whether that's generally assets, can all unravel within 12 months of not working. So I think the way that I used to discuss it with clients is, this actually needs to form part of the plan, and you need to find room for this in the budget. Doesn't mean it has, you know, you have to have the absolute works, but you need something to fall back on, that, you know, all this hard work you're putting in and, you know, savings and building assets, you don't want it to unravel. So the longer we're in business, the more claims we see, and the more, I guess, the more staunch we are on getting out, making it part of the overall plan, because we sit on the other side and we see what happens when people don't have it and the complexities that can cause. So
yeah, I was just going to say, like I say, particularly to younger people that have a lot of working life left, like, for most people, their biggest asset is their ability to earn income. You know, they don't have an asset base behind them that's overly large, most people. So if they can't earn income, they're never going to – well, it's very unlikely they're going to get to that point from an asset point of view. You know, it's just, it's very difficult to do. And the only other thing I'd say, Marty, in terms of contingency planning, and it's not really an area that we delve into ourselves. You know, there are lawyers and solicitors that deal with it, but estate planning, so wills, powers of attorney, kind of goes hand in hand with insurance. And people will often say, you know, I don't have a complex situation, why do I need a will? But like, I think if you've got kids, you should have a will. If something happens to you and your partner, or if you're a single parent, what happens to your kids? What happens to your money? How does it get passed to them? Like, you know, this is just sort of a baseline that you should have.
It's never complex until it is, as they say. Yeah. And it's all right, devil's advocate. I've just taken out a big mortgage. Trying to raise kids. It's pretty expensive. What do I need to do? What could I do cost effectively to protect myself?
So there's four types of insurance that we deal with, basically. There's life cover, total and permanent disability cover, income protection, and trauma insurance. Now, the first three, life, TPD, and income protection, can all be funded through super. So most people, if they look at their super statement, particularly if they're with an industry fund, they are likely to have a small level of default cover that's automatically given to them. So they'll have something. But typically, if you get a quote based on your needs, you can fund the bulk of the premium through your super. Now, again, it's not to say that your super's irrelevant. You just shouldn't worry about costs, because you should always consider costs. But it is a great way to be able to cover yourself without impacting your personal cash flow. Trauma insurance is the only one that you can't pay for without a super. It's often joke, it's everyone's least favorite, but it's not overly expensive. You know, like, to give some context, for I'd say someone in their mid 30s to get 150 grand of trauma cover, you're probably looking 15, 20 bucks a month. That's typically what it costs. It's not overly expensive. And again, you're protecting yourself against really nasty illnesses, you know, cancer, trauma, heart attack, all that sort of stuff. But yeah, the vast majority of it can be funded through super. And the only other thing I'd say there, big misconception, people are under the impression that they have to go with their existing super fund to get insurance funded through their super. That's not the case. Like, you can go with any retail insurer, you know, a Zurich, a OnePath, an AIA, and fund it from your existing super fund. So, you know, you want to basically get a quote across the market, sort of similar to what a mortgage broker does, and pick the product that suits your needs and, you know, it's cost effective, and you can still fund it from whatever super fund that you hold. So you can sort of have the best of both worlds.
Yeah, it's just so important. Like, it, and I know I'm harping on about this, but when you see it on the other side, we've got so many clients that have claimed that are young, that have families, and it's actually not just about the money. It's obviously, the money is important, but it's the stress relief when you know financially things are sorted, and you can then refocus your attention back on what you need to, which in most cases is trying to get healthy. So it's absolutely pivotal, and there are so many different ways to get a mix of cover to make sure you're going to be okay, different ways to pay for it. And back to your point around the super, Luke, you know, of course, ideally you'd pay for it out of your own cash flow, but if your primary objective at that time is to be insured, it's however you can do it, right? So,
yeah, I was going to say, the only other little win you can have, and again, this goes to cash flow and being able to afford in the budget. A lot of people aren't across. So income protection, if you fund that one personally, most of the premiums are tax deductible as well. So it's the only one of the four. So, you know, if you've got healthy cash flows and you're earning a good wicket, you can get some good some good tax savings on the premium as well.
And that talks back to the knowledge piece, right? If you didn't know that, then you wouldn't know that. And, you know, if you're at the top, if you're in the top tax bracket, you're nearly saving half of the premium, give or take.
Yeah. I was just going to say, I had a client too that had trauma cover and was in a stressful role, but because of the payout, it actually changed their life. Like, once they recovered, they chose not to go back to that original job and take a new path in their life that was less stressful. So it's actually not only helps in regards to times of real distress, but it actually opened up a whole new way of thinking about life and gave that lady options that she just wouldn't have given that it was a terrible situation, but it ended up being a very positive situation in the end. So when you do see these things happen, you know how traumatic it is at the time. But, yeah, people make some amazing transitions through by being financially supported. So it's very, very well worth getting the advice piece looked at.
The only other thing I'd say, just another thought, one I've seen a lot in the last 12 months, I'd say, a lot of people that took this stuff out when they were younger. So you might have had someone 20 years ago that was in their early 30s with young kids, get all this cover in place, they had a mortgage at the time, and they've still got it. And, you know, for those of people that don't know, this all these insurances go up every year. Every year you get older, they're priced accordingly. The risk to the insurer increases, so they jump the premium up. I've seen plenty of people that are overinsured. You know, again, their kids are grown up, they don't have any debt anymore, they've built an asset base up because they've had 20 or 30 years of working life, and they're paying, you know, in some cases tens of thousands of dollars in premiums every year for stuff that they don't need, or they could at least greatly reduce from a cover point of view. And I see it all the time. Like, people just aren't across it. They don't review it. They think they still need it. They don't understand how it works. So if you've got it, it's always worth reviewing. I think you should review it annually, basically. Premium changes every year.
Yeah, and it's so important. So why would you not be reviewing it annually? That's such an important thing.
Oh, yeah.
All right, changing lanes a little bit. If I look at society today, the baby boomer population coming through, I think we've covered off on the fact that, you know, if you're, you know, you need a financial plan no matter how old you are, but perhaps it becomes even more important as you're pushing towards that retirement age, because you need to understand, well, number one, what do I want to do, or what do I want retirement to look like? And number two, if I'm not on track, what do I need to do to make sure that it looks that way? So I think the sooner you can get across that, the better, because you can make changes then and give yourself some time to make the changes. But the word retirement, what does it mean? Like, you know, people think about retirement and they say, well, that means I don't work and I might get a government pension and, oh, I've got my super there. But what actually happens when I retire? How does that look? Like, what are the key things that are going to change in my life and how's my money managed so that I can retire?
As I said before, I think the key thing is being in a position where you're choosing to, you know, if you're going to work, you're choosing the work. So if you're choosing to stop working, it's because you're in a position where you feel confident enough to do it based on, you know, the position you're in. In terms of, are you sort of saying the mechanics of it, like what, you know, how it all fits together?
I've got money in super, I've got a house. Like,
yeah.
How does that mean I never have to work again?
Yeah. So for people that don't know, so your superannuation, you basically are in what's called accumulation phase until at least the age of 60 these days. So that's, you know, as the name suggests, that's where you're contributing money in. You can't get access to it. You can't take any money out. And then when you reach age 60, that's where you hit what's called preservation age. If you are between 60 and 65 and you retire from a place of work, generally you get full unrestricted access to your super money. So it's open slather, basically. What most people then do is they start what's called a pension account, commonly known as an income stream account. And basically what happens is you then elect the amount of money that you want taken out as a regular you know, pension payment. So you might say, like I said before, you might decide that you need 80 grand a year to live on. You might have done well and you've got $1 million saved up in your super fund. And then you instruct your super provider that you want to start a pension account. You want to take out, you know, whatever it works out to be, 6.5, 7 grand a month, whatever it is, as a regular pension payment. And the super fund will make that regular payment every month, same as you know, a wage. And that's what you live on moving forward. Obviously, that amount is, or the longevity of your funds is typically dictated by how much you take out versus how that fund is performing. So that money stays invested. So like I said before, at that point, you're probably looking to take a bit of risk off the table. You know, you want to make sure that you're taking enough risk that it's going to grow at a reasonable rate, but you're not risking it. You're not risking it at all because, you know, if you're retired, you're not going to be putting any more money in 99 times out of 100. So you need it to grow to a point and allow yourself to take enough money out. When you get to age 67, that's the current age at the moment, that's when you're potentially eligible for an age pension. So for those that don't know, the age pension is assessed under two tests, the assets test and the income test. Assuming you're retired, you're typically going to be assessed under the assets test. There's an upper threshold and a lower threshold, and it's you're assessed if you're single or a couple, and if you're a homeowner or a non-homeowner. So each one of those distinctions has a different set of thresholds. So, you know, for example, if you're a couple that's a homeowner, it's like 1.005 million or something that they change every 6 months. But basically, if you've got under $1 million in assets, excluding in most cases your family home, you're eligible for at least a part pension. And basically, they work out what your asset base is. They do a calculation. And then as your asset base slowly gets drawn down, your age pension allocation increases. So, you know, a lot of people, they'll have money that they're drawing from their super. They'll have at least a part pension coming in. You know, other little things as well. Like you get the age pension, you get the pension, the concession card. So you get all your, you know, you get rego discounts, you get utilities discounted. All these bits and pieces add up. Yeah, so there's a variety of streams. And then depending on what other investments you've accumulated, you know, someone might have a rental property. So they've got rent coming in. So, and this is where the planning comes in. Like if you need 80 grand, well, where's it going to come from? You might have 20 coming in from a rental. You might have 50 coming in from your super. Again, if you're eligible for a small bit of part pension, that fills in the rest. And you adjust as you go along.
I guess most importantly, you're there ensuring people have got enough and are making decisions that mean their money will last, you know, because how do you know, okay, if I'm pulling 80,000 out, well, when's that tap going to turn off? So I think probably one of the most important roles you play is giving people comfort that, hey, you can take that 80 or you can actually take 100 or no, we need to wind it back to 60.
Yeah. And that's where, like I was saying before, that's where the projections come in. Yeah. You know, you can, if you spend 100 a year, this is what it's going to look like. If you spend 90 or 80, this is what it looks like. If you want to spend 100 and you're prepared to downsize, you can do both. You can spend your 100 and still be comfortable longer term. And then they make those decisions. Like ultimately, I always say this to clients, like this isn't it's not a dictator relationship. I don't say you have to do this and you do it. Ultimately, my job is to show them what their choices are going to mean longer term. You know, with all the data that we have, and again, and you're making assumptions, you don't know what the future is going to hold, but you're empowering them to make those decisions. It's their money at the end of the day. But as long as they know that this decision will result in, or likely result in this outcome, then they can make an informed decision. Ultimately, it's about making an informed decision. And the only other thing I'd say there, like around planning, you know, the strategies around maximizing Social Security, Centrelink entitlements, like, you know, a little nugget for people listening if they're in this bracket or have parents or whatever in this bracket. So as I said, typically the family home isn't assessed as an asset unless it's on over 2 hectares, I think it is. Then it can be assessed depending on, there's a whole range of factors there. But assuming you're in just a normal house, the home isn't assessed at this point. The other thing that isn't assessed, if you're married or you're in a de facto relationship, if your spouse is underage pension age, and their super is still in accumulation phase like we were talking about before, that is also not counted as an asset. So, you know, and again, real life example, couple I spoke with last week, husband was age pension age, the wife had just turned 65, so she's 2 years off age pension age. We want to silo as much of their super savings as we can in her name in accumulation phase because it's not counted for Centrelink. If she put her money into pension phase, they would the husband would be ineligible for any pension. They'd be over the assets test. Based on putting it in her name, he's eligible for the full pension until she turns 67. So it's 35 grand odd over 2 years that he will get as a result of that little, you know, that little decision.
And that's interesting. So I guess as well as, okay, this is how much you need to put away so you can live a comfortable retirement, you're also looking at, okay, well, what other options are out there from a benefit point of view, mainly from the government, and how do we maximise our chance of getting access to that money? I think that's really important because, you know, in this country particularly we pay a lot of tax, and I've seen in my years planning, I've seen people almost want to almost being okay to lose money to guarantee that they got something back from the government. It's just this weird mentality that we had. So, a big part of what you do is also maximising those government benefits or showing people how to manage their money to maximise what they get from a government pension point of view.
You bring it back to the bigger picture. If someone can get 2 or 3 years a full age pension in that example, it might mean that their super lasts for another year. That's another year they've got a higher standard of living in retirement. That's maybe they can help their kids a bit more. Like, you know, all the financial stuff's good and the numbers are all good, but at the end of the day, it enables them to do more with their lives. So the only other one I'd say that I always, not always see, but see quite a bit, what we were talking about before with super accumulation phase, pension phase, the one of the other main differences. So in accumulation phase, again, your money's earning, your money's invested. And let's say you earn 10 grand in dividends in accumulation phase on your investment. That 10 grand is taxed at 15%. You don't see it most of the time. It's taken out in the background, but it's there. When you get into pension phase, the tax rate goes to 0%. So I see people all the time that are over 65. So when you turn 65, you can go into pension phase regardless of whether you're working or not. I see people all the time that are over 65. You know, they might have $1 million in super and they're still in accumulation phase because they don't need the money. I say you might not need the money, but if you move to pension phase, you're going to pay no tax on the earnings. So on $1 million, if you make a 5% return, you might be saving yourself $7,000-$8,000 a year in earnings tax. And again, like, that person might still be fine if they don't do it, but it's money they're leaving on the table for no reason.
Well, Luke, we're definitely going to have you back on the show because there's just so much knowledge that you've shared with the audience today. It's incredible stuff. And again, if you ever thought you didn't need a professional, my goodness, yeah, I'm sitting here drinking it all in, taking notes, and it's just fantastic. There's so many more questions that I have, but would you come back down the track and help us out?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Luke. Yeah, apart from being a Richmond supporter, you've had your success, mate.
Tough times.
Tough times at the moment. But thank you for coming on. Great insights. And again, if you want to protect yourself against your debt, if you want a blueprint for the future, if you don't know where you're going, you're not going to get there. And Luke will help you to get there wherever it is you want to go. So thank you for jumping on. And until next time, game over.
This podcast is for educational and informational purposes only. The conversations are of a general nature and do not qualify as financial or tax advice. We recommend before you make any financial decisions, you consult a licensed professional. Individuals on the podcast may hold positions in the companies discussed.